KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Mina Kim. Coming up this hour, author Colson Whitehead's book, The Underground Railroad, earned him the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and the National Book Award. He's followed it up with a novel titled The Nickel Boys, inspired by the true story of a state-run juvenile reform school in Florida, which for more than a century subjected boys and young men to abuse and brutal punishment, including long periods of solitary confinement and sometimes fatal beatings. The gruesome truth was uncovered by archaeology students in Florida who were digging up remains in the school's official cemetery. Colson Whitehead joins us right after this news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Mina Kim, and this hour I'm delighted to have with us author Colson Whitehead. His novel, The Underground Railroad, was inspired by the network of trains that helped slaves escape captivity in the 19th century. It tells the brutal truth of slavery and its crushing human toll. Published in 2016, it earned him the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and the National Book Award. And now he's followed up with The Nickel Boys. It's a novel inspired by the gruesome but true story of a state-run reform school in Florida that subjected boys and young men to vicious punishment, often fatal, as well as humiliation and emotional torture for about a century. And Colson Whitehead, welcome to Forum.
Howdy do.
Howdy do. Let me just, before we get to this book, this was not the book you were going to write after The Underground Railroad, I understand, from interviews I've read. What was it about this story that made you sort of stop in your tracks?
Yeah, I usually do something heavy and then something lighter because it's a lot easier on my psyche to do that. But I came across the story of Dozier and news reports, and when it came time to pick my next book in the spring of 2017, I realized I was compelled to pick up the topic. There's one main character is very optimistic. His name is Elwood. The other one is sort of more realistic or cynical. And I was having a lot of doubts about where the country is going. Trump had just been elected, and all the sort of divisions we'd suppressed for a while were back to the fore. And it seemed by having these two characters and their sort of philosophical war about how to be and how to live in America would help me sort through my own feelings about where the country's going.
And Elwood Curtis, one of the main, sort of the main character, I guess you might say, along with his friend Turner, they find themselves in this so-called reform school, and before he gets there, Elwood is sort of the perfect kid. You know, he is on a track toward college. He's taking advanced classes in high school. His parents abandoned him, but his grandma was very supportive. What was it about? Why did you decide to make a character like that? You know, sort of the eyes through which this story is told.
Well, there are a couple things. You know, he hitchhikes with the wrong person. It's a stolen car, and he gets sent to Nickel Academy. And he's, you know, in that instant, he becomes one of so many young people of color, who can have their lives changed and altered by any encounter with law enforcement. You're walking down the street at the wrong time, and if you reach too quickly for your identification, you can be shot. You can be taken to jail, and your life is put off course. And so he's an innocent and gets sent there through no fault of his own. So he's a stand-in. And then secondly, I said the book in 63. It could have been 85, could have been 2010. But it's the height of the Jim Crow era, and also a time where we've seen a lot of movement in terms of social progress. And so Elwood is 16. He's seen Martin Luther King march and protests and boycotts work. And so he's part of this generation. Of course, once he gets into Nickel, all these lofty ideas are put to the test.
I'm curious, you know, why you chose the name Nickel. I mean, the real school was, I think, Dozier. I mean, Nickel sort of implies cheap, nickels and dimes, you know, dime a dozen, you know, like this is just something that happens all the time. How did you come up with that name?
Their lives are cheap. It was funny because I actually had the school called Blackwood for the whole time I wrote the book. Then I handed the book in and my editor said, there's like three Blackwood schools are going to sue. So you have like 3 days to come up with a new name. And Nickel just sounded right. I was trying to find a nice range of syllables. And then, of course, you can get puns in terms of their lives weren't worth a plug Nickel. Some wordplay about a dime a dance. And so, yeah, I mean, it's sort of wonderful when you make a sort of accidental choice and it ends up paying off.
Yeah, so to speak. Sure. And talk about the real school for a moment, the Dozier Academy. I mean, this is a place that was a state-run school founded, I think, in 1899, at least according to the book. I don't know if that's an actual year that it was founded. But it was destined for development, and there were some archaeological students digging on the property, and they began to find all these bones. Did you talk to the students, the ones who were doing the digging? I mean, how did they play into your research for this book?
It was a reportage about them excavating the site that first introduced me to the school. The school closed in 2011. They were going to sell the land, and they found 55 unmarked graves. And the University of South Florida was doing forensic examinations. They found kids who died of influenza, but also kids with buckshot in their skeletons. People who died from blunt force trauma to their skulls. And for years, there have been legends about kids who died. Their parents were told that they ran away, but actually that they're still in the ground. For research, I went to the newspaper reports. There are some memoirs, survivors' websites. But I didn't talk to anybody until after I was done with the book. I wanted to keep the setting, but populate it with my own characters.
So you didn't talk to anybody, meaning any of the former students or staff or anything like that? You just read the accounts in the newspaper?
No, sure. Not until the book was announced, and then I started getting emails from people, and weirdly, the older version of Elwood moves to New York in the 70s, and he lives in the West 80s off Broadway.
And you're talking about the character in the book.
The character in the book. And I got an email from a Dozier survivor who moved to New York in the 70s and lived in the West 80s. And so he only lived like 5 blocks away from me. So we had lunch, and he gave me his story of his time there. And so far, everyone's been positive about the book. Unless they're just humoring me, but
I think it was on Barack Obama's summer reading list, wasn't it?
Yes.
Not quite Oprah, but maybe it was on hers too. I don't know.
No, I was very glad. It's nice to have a president who reads, who knows how to read, and so I was very glad. But in terms of the survivors, I've been glad that if my book even approaches 10% of what they went through. I'm very happy.
Yeah. What was the proportion, as far as you know, of the racial demographics of this school? Because obviously in the book, the kids who are kids of color, especially the black kids, are subjected to much worse treatment of all kinds. And yet when I went to that website, was it the White Boys? I forget the name of the website.
White House Boys.
White House Boys, yeah, and we'll talk about what the White House was. But most of the pictures were older white men who had been in the school. And so I was just wondering, is that because that's who's running the website or because of that's the photos, that happens to be the photos they have? Or like what was the breakdown and what do you think of the way it's remembered now?
Yeah, it was majority African American. And that's one of the things that stuck out to me when I first came across the story. The older survivors, men in their 60s and 70s were all white. It varied in terms of racial makeup from year to year, but, 60, 40, 55, 45 percent. And so I wondered what stories I could get out of the black side of campus, the colored half. It was severely segregated, and anyone you talk to would say that the white boys got it bad and the black boys got it worse.
Yeah, and we alluded a moment ago to the White House, where the black kids called it the ice cream. I'm sorry, it was the other way around, right? There was called the ice cream factory by some of the kids, the White House by some of the others. Describe, why they called it that, and that actual building was there. I mean, that was a place where punishment was meted out.
Sure. There were always tales of abuse throughout the decades, and they would outlaw the use of solitary confinement or corporal punishment. I think in the 40s they outlawed what they called spankings, which is, severe flogging, which just meant that they relocated it to a utility shed on the campus, a white cement building called the White House. And they brought in an industrial fan that was very loud to mask the sound of the screams and the beatings. And the white kids called it the ice cream factory. That was their sort of gallows humor nickname for it, because you came out with bruises of every color. And it was called the White House in real life, and I'm not going to mess with such a great detail. I couldn't really outdo the resonance of those two words.
Talking with Colson Whitehead, his new novel is called The Nickel Boys. And one of the things that, of course, stands out in this book, as it does in your previous book, The Underground Railroad, is the matter-of-fact tone in which some of the things are described. And one just really stuck out with me. It was the White House. Elwood is taken there. He's severely beaten. He's brought to the hospital. And you'd mentioned that it took a couple hours for the doctors to get the denim fibers from his jeans out of his skin. And there's the phrase, tweezers did the trick. Just so matter of fact, and it's just chilling. And there are many other examples like that where things are just understated. Talk about that as a sort of a writing tool, a strategy.
No, yeah, you picked the right tool for the job. I had a zombie novel 10 years ago, and that's and the violence in there is very much in a tradition. It's gory and garish. But in reading slave narratives for Underground Railroad, I was struck by the matter-of-factness. You don't have to sell the violence and the depravity. It speaks for itself, so you don't have to dramatize it for the listener or the reader. And I kept that detail from slave memoirs and used it in Underground Railroad. And in terms of the Nickel Boys, you know, Elwood is beaten in the White House, but I don't describe it actually. I describe his anticipation, the sounds. And you know, the psychological toll it takes on him, because it's really about the boys. And I'm not trying to exploit what happened. I'm not trying to over-dramatize it. You know, the line about tweezers, I think, says it all. And I think that understated approach brings the characters and their plight to center stage and not so much the brutality.
One of the themes that came out to me in reading this book was complicity, and how many people knew but didn't want to know or didn't think about it, you know, what was happening to these boys and young men for so many years. Doctors, teachers, people who would come and go from the grounds of the school, parents perhaps, even family members. I mean, what do you make of that complicity, the silence, really? And of course, it's very different reasons for different people. But what are your thoughts on that?
No, sure. I mean, it's how the powerful treat the powerless. If people can get away with doing terrible things, they will. And there are a series of investigations and people make noise about reforms, no one is really invested in making things better for these kids. They just want it to recede from the news and proceed. You know, supplies from the school were sold to local merchants. Food went missing. There's a lot of corruption. And so even if you weren't sort of beating the kids, if you're an administrator at the school, you're part of this general corruption. And if you're in, you know, in the capital of Florida, hearing these reports, you know, there's no sort of profit in holding anyone accountable. And that's how it worked.
One of the kinds of sort of degradation that occurs is the textbooks that these kids get. They're handed down. They're secondhand books. They come from the white kids who are getting new, more modern books. And one of the things that the kids do, and I hope I'm not giving too much away.
No, it's for now. No.
Okay. I mean, it's a detail, but they will inscribe, because they know these books are going to the black kids, and they would write racist things in the books. And one of the first things the kids had to do when they got the books is take a black marker and fix, you know, erase these messages as if you could really erase them once they've been read.
And that's not even in the Dozier part. That's the, you know, Elwood School in Tallahassee. And I got that detail from reading a history of the black part of Tallahassee called Frenchtown. And she was writing about going to school there, high school in the 60s. And yes, the brand new textbooks go from the white part of town to the black part of town. and they leave little gifts, the students, and the cuss words and the N-word. And that was just a daily fact of black life. You know, it's sort of one small detail that speaks to the general degradation of Jim Crow and segregation.
We mentioned that Elwood in the book is inspired by Martin Luther King. This takes place, begins, I think, in 1963, as you said, and King's giving speeches. The civil rights movement is happening. There's progress. There's the sit-ins at the lunch counters and so on. And he is inspired by the part of King's message, which was fundamental, that, you know, love is really the answer. You know, you can beat us, you can lynch us, you can do all these things, and we will still love you. And I'm wondering, you know, how do you feel about that message, you know, as we sit here in 2019, but also in writing the book? I mean, in having Elwood have a character be, initially at least, you know, inspired by that message.
Yeah, I mean, I picked 63, and so who would Elwood think I would look up to? And that's Dr. King and his gang of civil rights crusaders. But it is one thing to have this beautiful, enlightened rhetoric. How do you hold on to that in a place like Nickel? You know, in some ways, Elwood is this, you know, super goody-goody kid and, you know, too good to be true. In, you know, figuring out which Dr. King speeches to use in the book, which ones would speak to Elwood's character, which ones would speak to the higher themes of the book. It was nice to be reminded how miraculous he was. I could never do what he did, you know, to march and know that 10 blocks away there are white men with fire hoses and axes and guns waiting to beat you up year after year, day after day. You know, they were just an incredible generation that did affect change, and definitely in darker moments in the last 2.5 years, when I think of where we're all headed, it is inspiring, you know, to think of what those guys did and how they lived by their ideals.
Do you think, by, you know, now that here we are in modern in the moment, I mean, do you feel that that's still a relevant message?
It's a relevant. It's relevant. I'm not sure how much it applies to my daily existence.
What do you mean?
I'm certainly not up for loving the current administration. And I'm glad that there are other people who are definitely more noble than I am. Right now, we're having this great climate change protest across the country. And
it's going to be across the street in about an hour.
Across the street. And there is this beautiful generation that's engaged. And we screwed up a lot of stuff. And hopefully there are some really energetic 16-year-olds like Elwood was back then who can fix things, because we definitely are not up to the task.
Not to harp on it too much, but you have Cory Booker, for example, running for president. And that's part of his message, too, you know, that we have to love each other. And certainly you can say, yeah, sure, you know, that's true. But is that the right way to respond to all these, you know, things that that the country is going through right now?
I'm just a humble scrivener, humble novelist, trying to get through the day. So I'll leave that to Mr. Booker.
Yeah.
To make the case.
You mentioned that you talked to some of the people who had been in the real Dozier School. What did they tell you? What struck you? What did you, after talking with them, were there things about the book that you felt you had maybe either gotten wrong or that you would like to do differently?
No, I'm pretty happy with the book, and from talking to them, you know, they seem to like it. There's so much of their stories in the book, you know, the small details about how they lived and how their lives were altered by this moment. If you go to the Survivor website, they'll talk about their time at Dozier, but also the decades and how they tried to make a life after being put off course. Some of them became habitual criminals. You know, they were forever changed, became addicts, alcoholics, were never really able to fit in with us normal folks. And you hear it in their voices. You hear it when they talk about the school. A sort of, you know, transformation as they're brought back to that time. So, you know, my book takes place mostly in 63, but then it follows Elwood in the 70s and 80s. And it was very important for me to narrate that that journey back from trauma. You know, we have a conversation now about PTSD, and we understand now how those kind of life-changing events stay with you and alter you in profound ways. So narrating Elwood into adulthood as he finds himself was very important to me.
I'm always struck by men who are exonerated, you know, who've been in prison for decades in some cases, and they get out, they get freedom. Their families in some cases are gone. Sometimes they're back with their families, but they have to start over, you know. And I'm just always amazed at how magnanimous sometimes that they are. You know, it's hard to imagine, and I wonder what you think. You know, do you wonder how you would respond, not just to being falsely imprisoned, but to going through an experience like the ones that Elwood and Turner and these other boys did?
Yeah, I mean, it's my job to sort of imagine it, and hopefully, you know, I get a fraction of it right. But it is sort of unfathomable. And then talking to people who were there or their families, you know, I talked to some people who would say, oh, my uncle was there, and we never talked about it. Or, my brother Jeff was there, and he came back, and he was never the same. And so... it really is, you know, hopefully so far out of our experience.
I've met people who have been in concentration camps, you know, and they have the numbers tattooed on their arms, and oftentimes that you would never know it. You know, they don't want to talk about it. It's not that they won't talk about it, but it's not forefront, you know, in their minds and their things that they want. They've moved on, obviously. But in some ways, you can't move on.
No, I mean, and it's an experience like Dozier. It's sexual abuse. It's, you know, being raised in a house with an abusive parent. And I think now, you know, Dozier is closed, but we have these camps for incarcerating refugees from on the border. And whether you're in these camps for 6 months or 6 weeks, it's you're changed for life. And the kind of devastation I'm talking about in terms of Dozier is happening, of course, on our southern border. And it'll be decades... the people will be, you know, processing what's happening to them now for decades to come.
Coming up on a break, but there's a theme of escape and capture, or being on the run, both in the Underground Railroad and then also in the Nickel Boys. Was that deliberate? You know, that idea of running away, and, you know, are they going to make it?
It wasn't on purpose. You know, Zone 1, my zombie book, has that same sort of structure. The survivors hoping for a human refuge somewhere, and of course Cora in the Underground Railroad has to hope that there's a place of freedom. So I'm not sure what's happening to me in the year 2009 that set me on this trend in these last three books. But if we're talking about survival, if you don't believe that there is a safe place, you don't run, you don't try to change, and so it's important.
All right, Colson Whitehead is going to be with us for the rest of the hour. If you'd like to join us, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, it's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or you can email your questions the old-fashioned way, forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Mina Kim. Stick around for more of our conversation. And welcome back to Forum. My guest this hour is Colson Whitehead. His new book is called The Nickel Boys. You may have heard of his previous book, The Underground Railroad, as well. He would be happy to talk about all those things and more. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or send us your thoughts via Twitter. We're at KQED Forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org. You know, one of the things I noticed in the Nickel Boys was this sort of undercurrent of homosexuality or implications about it. One or more of the house fathers would watch the kids shower. There was the kid who was bullied, Corey, I think his name was, and there's an implication that perhaps he was giving sexual favors as part of this bullying. And there were one or two other things. And I'm just wondering, like, what was that? In the book,
well, you know,
did it come from, in fact, the, you know, what happened there at the school, or?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, that's what happens in all male environments in reform schools and in jails and prisons, and one of the things that struck me was like kids talking about the school psychiatrist who do their intakes, watching them shower and, you know, sort of picking people, grooming people from their interviews. And so
grooming them to be predators.
Yes, I mean,
They were.
And there's sort of a lot more, you know, there's, you know, there are a lot of references to rape rooms in the accounts of survivors. I sort of don't go into that because I want to concentrate on Elwood and Turner. But basically, everything that's terrible in the book comes from real life, and it's probably 10% of what happened there. So
yeah, and you heard that also from some of the men who you talked to afterwards.
Yes,
more recently.
Yeah.
I want to give out the phone number again if you want to give us a call. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Talking with Colson Whitehead about his new book, The Nickel Boys. I'm wondering, as an African American writer, you probably hate sentences that begin like that. Do you feel?
It's not a good start. Usually,
do you feel like there's an expectation on you to somehow represent "quote unquote"? I don't even know what the black experience, or to speak for you know, the African American community, or Black Lives Matter, or to comment on things that, you know, that white writers wouldn't necessarily be expected to talk about.
Sure, I mean, I think less now than say 1950 or 1970, when there could only be like sort of one black writer, and you had to represent some idea of an authentic black experience. I think less so in the States and more abroad, where, you know, sometimes I'm like the only black person in the country, it seems. And in an interview, I'll do, you know, one question in the book, and the rest of it is ask a black guy a random question, you know, sort of, you know, why is Barack Obama considered black when he has a white mother?
People ask you that?
Yes, more than once. Generally, the whiter the country, the weirder the question. Has been my general rule, and are definitely places I don't, you know, feel like going back to. I think that, you know, that's an old paradigm that doesn't really operate anymore, particularly in America, but abroad, definitely.
Hmm. What about your own family? You grew up, you were born and raised in New York, spent a little bit of time out here in California, which I'll ask you about later, but, you know, did race, did family heritage, did your own, you know, did you go back and trace your own family roots at all?
My parents didn't talk about their background, their family history that much, so I was never that really interested. When I the Underground Railroad came out, and I would talk about slavery and not knowing certain parts of my history, I had uncles who got really angry and were like, don't you know that this fact, blah, blah, blah. And then actually a reader pieced together some of my family history from interviews and trace back my father's family to Georgia and Florida in the late 19th century. And one thing I used from that was the name Turner. I have an ancestor named Turner who was in Georgia in the 1880s, and I was trying to find a name for, you know, my secondary character in the book and use that.
Yeah. And so your family wasn't something that you guys talked about when – and you have – how many siblings do you have?
I have two siblings.
Two siblings. So it wasn't something – I mean, I don't know. What do they do, for example, for a living?
My sister works in admissions at a private school in Westchester. And my other sister is a traveling nurse doing 6 months here, 6 months there.
Yeah. And what do they make of your being, you know, a hotshot writer?
we're a very, you know, bookish family. And I became a writer from reading, like, my mother's, like, Stephen King. You know, we give her – every Christmas, we'd buy the new Stephen King, and that would be passed around us kids, and then I would eventually come to me. My sisters, you know, they were high school kids in the 70s and 80s, so I would read their Tom Wolfe books, you know, get all their magazines and their music. And so we were very much into pop culture, and it was a really communal thing for us. And so a lot of my tastes in books and music comes from them.
Yeah. Are your parents still around?
My father passed away 10 years ago. My mom moved out to Sag Harbor, which, you know, I wrote a book about.
That's Long Island.
In Long Island. And she moved out there 30 years ago.
Yeah. And you did, as I mentioned a moment ago, you lived in San Francisco. We were talking about that during the break. 20 years ago? How long was it?
20 years ago. And actually, speaking of my mother, I remember I had sold my first book when I was out here, The Intuitionist. And she said, "That's great. Don't quit your day job." You know, they didn't really understand how their son, became a writer, and it wasn't necessarily real to them until the book came out and they could hold it in their hands.
Yeah. Were there teachers you had? Who was it that encouraged you, if anyone, to write?
Nobody. I was not really a kid that people took a shine to or mentored or encouraged in terms of writing. You know, whenever I applied for workshops in college, I was always turned down.
Really?
Which was very depressing. But looking back, it was, good training for being a writer, because when you're a writer, generally people – hate you, don't want to read your stuff, and if you internalize that hatred early, you'll be prepared later.
But you married a literary agent, I think, didn't you?
Yes. she had a rule about not dating writers, because most of us are kind of crazy and weird. But apparently, I'm within the acceptable range.
Just barely. What? So you say no, you didn't really have mentors who were encouraging you to write. Did you go to like public school? I mean, what?
No, I went to private school, but nobody particularly cared. it wasn't about the school. I think it's about my personality. My mentors were Stephen King and Rod Serling and Arthur C. Clarke and Ursula K. Le Guin, and then later Ralph Ellison and Toni Morrison and Thomas Pynchon, these people who were creating art that moved me in profound ways and made me want to write. You know, when I was a kid, I'd read X-Men and Spider-Man, and that seemed like a great job to have, like writing or drawing comic books. So so the people who inspired me were the artists, whether it was Stanley Kubrick or Garcia Marquez, who were, making art that moved me profoundly.
You said it was your personality that prevented people from mentoring. I don't know if that was really a joke, or do you really think that's true?
I don't know. I have to go back and contact all those wonderful teachers
who ignored you.
They didn't take a shine to me. Yes. Yeah.
They haven't reached out and said, "Oh, it's so." I knew you had potential.
Not yet. No.
Okay. All right. Let's go to the phones. And again, the number to call is 866-733-6786. Phil in Burlingame, you're on with Colson Whitehead.
Hi. There's the idea of cruel and unusual punishment, and you have a unique perspective on this. I'd be interested to know, these terrible environments that the state puts these kids, why is it allowed? And what is the relationship?
Well, in terms of the depravity, I think we have a deep flaw in ourselves as human beings, and it doesn't take much to express it. Sometimes it's being able to get away with it. Sometimes it's perhaps a demagogue who says it's okay to hate other people. And so... we're pretty flawed creatures. In traveling with the book, in Ireland, people said, "Oh, this reminds me of the St. Mary's School for Girls." 2 years ago, there was a home for unwed mothers, and they found the bodies of babies and children. I was in Canada. People talked about the residential schools there, where they took Indigenous children away from their families to tutor them in, so-called white culture. And the same kind of abuses happened as what happened at Dozier. So it happens everywhere. We're often quite terrible to each other, and that's sort of an unfortunate fact.
Phil, does that respond to your question?
Very much. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. That idea of cruel and unusual punishment, a lot of the things that are in this book are horrifying, but, there's also this notion, George W. Bush did a lot of things wrong, but I think it was in his inaugural address, he used this phrase, the soft bigotry of low expectations. And that's a whole other – there's some of that in this book as well, where kids of color especially are just – they're put on a different track because there are low expectations. Does that figure in to this book?
Well, it's race and also poverty, Dozier was white kids. It was black kids, and the kids in the school weren't just juvenile offenders. They were also orphans or wards of the state, kids from broken homes. If you had nowhere else to go, they sent you to Dozier. I sort of lost my train of thought.
Well, the low expectations and, you know, kids who go to these ended up at that school were just sort of like in some ways cast-offs. But in the case of Elwood, no, he was a good kid on the right track in the wrong place at the wrong time. Plus, he was a kid of color and was sitting next to a guy who had picked him up hitchhiking.
No, yeah, all the kids are written off, which is why people can no one stepped up to protect them. And after every investigation and every promise of reform, no one would check in because no one actually cared.
What have you heard, if anything, from you know, the people that ran this school or officials in Florida who, you know, learned about this, or maybe they knew about it, but since it came to light, you know, have had to answer questions about it?
Yeah, no one has approached me. A lot of the guys who were famously terrible in the 50s and 60s, you know, worked there for decades, retired, got their pensions. There's a guy named Tidswell who did a lot of the beatings, and he, you know, would get Citizen of the Year awards. And when they
recently,
yeah, like, you know, last 10 years. And he passed away recently, but newspapers would go up to his porch and say, you know, what happened there? And he would just say, oh, it's just a little bit of spanking. You know, it's all sort of exaggerated. But no one's ever held accountable. And definitely in terms of investigating who murdered the kids with buckshot in their skeletons, you know, that'll never be solved.
And so there's been no effort at all to investigate.
The state of Florida apologized. And some of the survivors are trying to get reparations, but, you know, as a freelancer, I certainly never expect to get paid on time. And when it comes to government redress for wrongs, the coins don't necessarily flow very quickly.
Talking to Colson Whitehead about his new book, The Nickel Boys. If you want to join us, give us a ring at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email us if you'd like. It's forum@kqed.org or reach out on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. I'm wondering, are you thinking ahead to the next book already, or does it not work that way? Are you still so immersed in this one?
Yeah, you know, in the spring of 2017, I had two books, and I picked the heavier one. I'm not sure why, but it worked out okay. So I'm back to this crime novel I was planning. It takes place in the 60s, and it's very fun. You know, there's more room for jokes and, you know, in the criminal subculture. And the research is fun. You know, I'm walking around Harlem trying to, you know, location scouting. Is this where my character lives? Is this where his office is? And one of the interesting things is that I'll tell my mother about some of my research, like the Hotel Teresa was like the Waldorf of Harlem, and like Castro stayed there and Muhammad Ali. And he's like, oh yeah, I was at the Chock-Full, and that's on the first floor there every day. There's a department store called Blumstein's, which is like the Macy's of Harlem, and it was research. I told my mom, she's like, oh yeah, your dad worked there two summers. So instead of, you know, doing all this research, I should just ask her. Harlem in the 60s.
When you're writing a book like The Nickel Boys or The Underground Railroad, I mean, what effect does it have on you, or like, personally, I mean, emotionally?
In general, I haven't, you know, the material is always very separate, and I clock in at 10 and stop at 3 or 3:30, and that's it. With The Nickel Boys, I think writing about slavery and then institutional racism at Dozier, the last 6 weeks were very hard. You know, there was still some research I could have done, and I was just too depleted at the end of the day. I was so invested in Elwood and Turner and trying to do justice to the real-life survivors' stories in whatever way I could. That I was really depressed.
And what – I mean, depression isn't always logical, but, like, what was it that you feel made you depressed?
I had set these boys on a course, you know, 2.5 years before. I plotted out the story. And the closer I got to the end of the book and the resolution I'd planned, the more I felt bad for them. I felt bad for the real-life kids whose stories I was echoing. And, you know, usually I like doing field research. It makes me feel like I'm a real writer, get my little badge. But I couldn't go to Dozier. I kept putting it off and putting it off. And I realized that I would only go there with like a stick of dynamite and a bulldozer. I was so angry and despairing about the whole story that I never went. And now I can't go because Hurricane Michael actually destroyed it a year and a half ago.
So you never did go?
No, no. And don't intend to.
There are so many reasons to grab a stick of dynamite and be angry. Pick one over the last century or more, two centuries. What does that do to a person?
Whatever I feel about it is a fraction of what the real...
Sure, but I mean, in general, do you think?
It helped when I handed in the book to play video games for 6 weeks and veg out and cook and hang out with my family. And I think it'll be a while before I write a book like The Underground Railroad and Nickel Boys again that sort of deals with race and American history in that way. I feel like I've sort of done that, bit for a while.
Because of the effect it had on you, or partly?
Because I've sort of said my piece. In the same way, I'm not really writing books about contemporary America. Zone One and John Henry Days are very much about contemporary life here. And I think I've said my piece and don't have much more to add. So I think it's important not to do the same thing all the time. And there's overlap between Underground and Nickel, even though the stories, one's fantastic and one isn't. And so what I like about writing is not doing the same thing all the time and picking new challenges. So for me, not necessarily writing a book like Nickel anytime soon is useful.
Do your kids ask you, do they read your books, number one? Do they ask you questions?
My son is six and mostly
not appropriate.
Mostly likes me to read Lego catalogs to him. That's like Batman Batcave set number 227. So my daughter is 14 and she's starting to pick up my books and put them down and sort of warily check them out. So when she's ready, she'll read them or not read them. Last week she said, do you want me to read Sag Harbor, which is very autobiographical but also deals with being a teenager and that sort of identity formation, which she's going through now. And I was like, if you want to, I'm not going to make you read it. So hopefully, it speaks to her experience. And whenever she picks it up, I hope she likes it.
What about your wife?
She's a great reader. And I can, and generally, I can get 100 pages into a book. And then I need a reality check. Like, is this book stupid? Am I just an idiot? So I'll give it to her after 100 pages. And she's usually very supportive, and that gives me enough speed to get to the end. Unfortunately, if someone likes the first 100 pages, that means for another 200 pages, I'm just like, don't screw it up, Coulson. Like, don't mess it up,
You still have that voice?
And I think, fear keeps you honest. I mean, I think if you esteem yourself so highly that you can't make a mistake, you're probably going to make some mistakes. And So worrying about the quality of the work page by page and sentence by sentence at least works for me.
In that regard, what did the success, the critical success and popular success of the Underground Railroad, what did it have on you? I mean, obviously, financially it helped, and I'm sure it helped getting the next, advance for the next book and all that. But how did it affect you?
Well, it was a great year in terms of publication. I handed it in, and my editor was... I like this book. I like all your books, but I like this one a little more, sort of like the subtext. And I went to booksellers and then readers and critics and people, sort of came to the work in a different way. And then, culminating with the Pulitzer, obviously you don't think that's going to happen to you when you're writing. So I was really happy for like a year. And and then life has a way of, reminding you of its sort of ups and downs. In terms of the work, after writing for 20 years, I know that whether it goes well or poorly and nobody likes your last book, you're always just sitting there the next day trying to find the words. It doesn't make it harder or easier because it's always, difficult in its own way.
And you I think it was 2002, you won the MacArthur so-called Genius Award, which is cash to basically help you do whatever it is you do. What about that? How did that help your writing?
Yeah, I took it as a message to say, keep being like your weirdo self. You're a weirdo. We like your first two books. Keep doing that. And it gave me financial security for the first time in my life. I'm not sure if we would have had, my wife and I would have had our first child without that. because everything was always so unstable. And so you don't have to show anything. They just give it to you, which is sort of wonderful. And I took it really as a message saying, you know, keep going.
Yeah, and which you did. Give us a call if you want to talk with us. It's 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Colson Whitehood is here for the rest. Whitehead is here for the rest of the hour. Again, it's 866-733-6786. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. So I know you I get the sense that you're not a highly political person, but I'm sure you're paying attention to politics. And I'm wondering, I don't know if you saw the debate last week, I guess it was, and Joe Biden was asked a question about, it was really a question about sort of reparations and the history of slavery. And he gave a long, rambling answer that never really answered the question, but talked about playing records for your kids and then went off to, I think, Venezuela and maybe Guatemala and talked about bringing social workers into the families to help black parents raise their kids. I mean, do you have conversations, you know, with your friends, with your family about that? I mean, how much are you paying attention to the way race is being dealt with or not dealt with in this campaign?
No, I mean, I'm obsessed with every sort of daily outrage in terms of the administration and then the political race. I've never tuned in as early as this before. In terms of Biden, you know, I'll support any Democrat who's the nominee. I feel weird that I would vote for Biden, but not necessarily trust him to get me to the train on time. You know, like, hold on, sport. You know, we're getting there. Oh, there's Jimmy from the Pipe Fitters Union. I'm going to stop and say hello. I don't need that. You know, I'll need you to take me to the train station, Biden. I just need you to defeat Trump. So, I think we're in a terrible time, and I think it'll get worse before it gets better. In traveling with the book in different countries, you know, we have these right-wing regimes and demagogues coming into power in Hungary, in Brazil, and I think we're going through a really sort of worldwide convulsion. So hopefully we'll pull out of it. And following the cycle of progressive times and more conservative times, hopefully we're nearing, the wheel is turning and we'll pull out of it.
Yeah. There's an article, I think it was today, when you read things online, you're not quite sure what day they were published, so to speak, but there's an article about how younger, like black millennials, are sort of this organic movement to have them talk to their parents to break up with Joe Biden, essentially, to like, no, don't vote for him for the reasons that you kind of alluded to a moment ago. Do you have, you know, similar ever conversations with your mom or your daughter, for that matter?
I talked to my mom about politics, and she sort of shakes her head. You know, she's at this point, she's just turned 80. She's seen it all. And I ask her, is it, you know, worse than it's ever been? She's like, no, it's often been pretty bad like this. And of course, in her lifetime, she's seen everything. My daughter is now marching in New York in the climate rally, and she's engaged in a way that reminds me, you know, of sort of me and my friends in the 80s. It was nuclear war, and we all sort of lived under that threat. That was our existential terror.
Three Mile Island.
Nuclear war. And I think now we have, you know, we've woken up to the complete reality of what climate change is doing. And so I'm really psyched that younger generation is standing up.
All right, let's go to the phones. And Angela in San Francisco, welcome. You're on with Colson Whitehead.
Oh, thank you so much. Colson, it's a delight. You are just what we need right now. You're what I need right now. And I do agree about the next generation, and I think your work is going to be brilliant in terms of motivating the next generation or motivating parents to motivate their next generation. But my question was about the Nickel Boys, and I have trouble with it because I found it devastating. And so people will say, oh, did you read that? And I'll say, yes, but it's devastating. And so it's hard for me to recommend it. I think people need to read it because it's so devastating. But as a person who likes to recommend good books, which it is. And so I'm curious, when you were writing it, how it's a devastating topic. How did you handle getting, I mean, you talked a little bit about kind of coming to the resolution because you'd planned it out, but daily, what did you do to just keep going? It's an important story, and I'm so grateful that you wrote it in your voice and with your eloquence.
Let's give him a chance to answer because we're almost at the end.
I was sort of all in with this book and also The Underground Railroad. Some of my books have a lot of jokes, and some of them don't. But if I was going to write about Dozier, I have to present it in all its brutality. If I was going to write about slavery, I can't whitewash it. I have to be truthful about it. You know, The Underground Railroad is not, say, Gone with the Wind, where a white lady is being self-actualized against the backdrop of slavery. Oh, they're burning my house down. Good, they should burn your freaking house down. You're a slaver. You know, so I have to present my reality, and it is a tough book. But also, there in the bookstore, there are a lot of books about puppies and stuff like that, and puppies who get lost and have to travel 1,000 miles to find their way home. And so, depending on your mood, pick up The Nickel Boys or The Amazing Adventures of Freckles.
Well, I can tell you, do not hesitate to read The Nickel Boys. It is a terrific book. Colson Whitehead, I should mention that you are appearing tonight at the Dominican University of California in San Rafael, 7
indeed,
o'clock.
Indeed.
Is that a conversation? Or is it?
I think I was doing like a bunch of weird bits and talking about the book. So,
all right. Very good. Well, thanks so much for coming in. I really appreciate it. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Mina Kim. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.